It's Your Money with the Investor Coach, Paul Nichols, the show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about the traditional financial planning model. Paul believes education plus understanding leads to clarity and confidence that can and will lead to peace of mind. He uses simple solutions grounded in academic research from leading financial minds at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and the University of Chicago, including several Nobel laureates. You do not need to know everything if you have an investor coach teaching you the few right things. Paul Nichols is the president of Financial Abundance, a registered investment advisor. He is a member of the National Ethics Bureau, the Better Business Bureau, and member of Strategic Coach Quarterly. Get ready for some common sense clarity coaching with the investor coach, Paul Nichols.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Paul Nichols, the investor coach. I hope this finds you well. This is Saturday morning. It's Your Money, and it is a rainy day in State College. In fact, we got a lot of liquid sunshine out there. Before you go outside, if you haven't looked out, you may want to put on your flippers and your floaties. But we are live and in color. It is Saturday morning. It's a football weekend. It's an away game, and it's a very special show today because I have a special guest coming on, someone that hasn't been on for about a year. And his name is Barry Dyke, and Barry has written a book called The Pirates of Manhattan, and he's working on another book. Barry was on the show about a year ago, and when he had written his book, it's kind of interesting, he ended up self-publishing the book, and the book has done extremely well. And so we asked Barry if he would be kind enough to come back on here. It's been about a year since we spoke, and catch up with him. Barry's really an expert as it relates to the banking systems, the insurance systems, kind of some of the regulatory things. He is a planner by trade up in New Hampshire, and we really feel fortunate to get Barry back on. I don't know, is he up yet, Jess? Can you hear me, Barry?
Paul, good morning.
Hey, how are you today?
Awesome, awesome. So it's raining down in Pennsylvania. It's raining up here, too, right?
Is it?
It's pouring, yeah. But let's see, every day is a good day. You wake up, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, how you been, Barry?
I'm doing awesome, Paul. I'm very grateful. Things are going well, and the book's done well, and my kids are healthy, my friends are healthy, so what else can you ask for, you know?
Well, that's right. I know you're working on a new book, aren't you, Barry?
Yeah, about the crisis. As a matter of fact, when I finished The Pirates, Paul, I said, you know, and then all the financial collapse started happening. I said, we're witnessing a once-in-a-lifetime event. And so I just started researching it right away. And it centers around the debt and what's happening about that.
Yeah, and I'm interested to talk a little bit about that with you. We wanted to go over a few things while you're on the show, Barry. One was just kind of catch up with what you're doing. I'd like to hear a little more about some of the things you've discovered for that book, if you feel so inclined to divulge those.
Sure,
at this point.
Sure.
Have you got a name for the book yet, or how much are you?
Well, tentatively, it's going to be The Pirates of Debt.
Okay.
I really want to have Merchants of Debt, but The Pirates of Debt, I'm kicking around the name. It's going to be kind of a acceleration of from the Pirates of Manhattan, but it's in my beliefs in the first book about life and annuity products being some of the best warehouses of money are still true, but this more or less goes and explains the broad scope of debt within American society and how it's all controlled by Wall Street and the banks.
Well, you know, Pirates of Manhattan was an eye-opening revelation for me when I had read the book, and of course we have it in the office, and we pass it out, and boy, we've gotten tremendous feedback. How's the book done now? It's been around, what, about 2 years now or something?
About 2 years. It's a bestseller, and thank you, God, and it sold, actually, this is a wonderful thing to say about the power of the Internet. The book is sold throughout the world virtually on word of mouth and with no help really from the media press. There's only one bookstore, and the reason why it's in that bookstore is that the friend of mine owns the thing, but he's a client, too.
Well, that's convenient.
But he likes it because he can say he's the only bookstore in the world that has it. But it's done really well, and despite, you know, the general press really kind of being kind of blowing me off, if you will. And it just shows the power of the internet and radio, which, as you know, my two favorite things.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that the press would want to squelch this kind of information because it's certainly, for a thinking person, if you take the information in and think through a process, it's hard to disagree with a lot of the facts and assumptions that you make in the book. Why do you think that that the mainstream media is not favorable in sharing that type of information, Barry? Have you come to some kind of conclusion there?
Yeah, well, think about it, Paul. It's, you know, we all do things for selfish reasons, and think about it. If you're running a newspaper or a traditional television station right now, I mean, you're watching advertising revenues plummet, you don't really want to aggravate your biggest advertisers, and some of their biggest advertisers are the mutual fund companies and the banks. And so anything that really discloses all the, you know, and these a lot of these publications and entities are really involved in selling your customers' products, so you really don't want to review something which is going to essentially piss off their advertisers.
Well, that's true. Yeah. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. I understand
exactly.
That conceptually. It seems like that there wouldn't be as much bias. I guess there's more bias than we think there is in the media.
Yeah, huh? Yeah. And I'll put this just in light. There's actually been as you know, about these target date funds, which are the default investment really in a 401k now. There's a Senator Herbert Kohl of Wisconsin. I don't mind saying this because I noticed that the Congress is going to do a study about the problem with target date funds, and I've done a tremendous amount of research on this stuff, and they're awful. And but I even offered to give them as expert witness testimony about my research, and that kind of blew me off. So again, the great thing is really the power of the internet and the radio, and just so I'm very confident in things. And I'm confident in seeing that more truth is coming out.
Well, there's more of us guys like that are more turning into more coaching type of models rather than advisor type models. And for those people, ladies and gentlemen, that may not understand what Barry was referring to with life cycle funds, that's what you're seeing a lot of in these 401ks, you know, like 2010. 2015, 2020, 2030 would be the name of them. It might say life cycle 2020, which means theoretically that you're going to retire at 2020. So this fund is going to appropriately balance itself out as you get closer to retirement, right, Barry? Is that the way you understand
that? That is correct, yeah. Essentially, it's a one-size-fits-all fund.
And I'll tell you, we've looked at them too, and the returns are dismal. We looked at a 2010 fund, Barry, last year. A 2010 fund with a major outfit lost 35%. Now, how can a fund that's supposedly two years away from retirement be have that much risk in it, or subject to that much volatility? You follow my thinking there?
Oh yeah, because no one knows what the future is going to bring, Paul, and no one does.
But for a company to sell a fund saying in 2010 it's set up for retirement and it loses 35% 2 years before, how can it be set up truly for a two-year retirement, two-year window from retirement? You see what I'm saying? I mean, that type of fund that's that close to the retirement target date should be very conservative, should it not?
Yeah, well, and the whole thing is that we really can't predict the future, Paul. No one can. I'm not God. I don't know you.
No, of course not. Nobody knows. I understand
it. No one knows the future. And the thing is, I don't know what's going to happen for lunch this afternoon, never mind next week. So how anyone can project 10, 20, 30 years out is absolute unequivocal lunacy. The best businesses, even someone like IBM, they project maybe 12 months to 24 months out. So, and these are some of the best minds, and even they have to readjust their courses. So the whole idea of a target date is more of a marketing
piece. That's totally what it is, Barry. It's totally marketing.
It's totally marketing. But the thing is that the American consumer has to know that this is the default investment of their 401k. So the vast majority of target date funds are in the 401k, and the marketing is stronger than ever, and this is where the money's going.
And you know what's interesting about those funds? The way they have them set up, it makes them a lot harder for a competitor to analyze that fund, by the way, which I think is kind of a little interesting caveat to the whole marketing scheme. They've really thought it through quite well.
Paul, yeah, I was just looking at one for a client, a friend of mine's mom, and she was in one of these things, Paul, and I tell you, I'm an RIA and all that stuff. I'm doing this for 25 years, and I looked at this thing, and it had like, they're essentially, some of these funds can be, or life cycle funds, they can be like, it was 34 different accounts within one mutual fund.
Unbelievable.
Makes my head hurt. I mean, and this is when it was in a $20,000 investment. I said, I can't figure this out. how can the consumer?
Yeah, and I mean, we're professionals. That's what we do every day. And I tell you, it's become more and more difficult. On a side note, to go in a different direction, and I wanted to cover this in this segment, we had a very interesting conversation earlier this week, and you were telling me about where the government keeps their retirement funds.
Yeah, well, this is the whole, yeah, this is the interesting thing, again, and this is where I may do YouTube or something like that. Essentially, the two things that which and I stumbled into this is that someone asked me for the Federal Reserve, and as you know, the Federal Reserve is not it's a private bank. But in any event, someone asked me for the financial and the Federal Reserve pension plan because it is separate from the government plan. And I didn't find that, but I found that and this is all very conclusive and it's bulletproof, is that essentially 69-70% of the Federal Reserve's 401k money, which is $3.2 billion, is in fixed accounts backed by fixed annuities.
Unbelievable.
Okay, this is true. Okay, and the only one who picked it up was the paper in London, and then. But I also found because doing this research, Paul, is kind of it's almost spirit brings you people into the fold. Is that a guy who is a specialist and he actually did some work for the Federal Reserve showed me how the Federal Thrift Plan, which is the largest thrift plan of them all. And it's around $240 billion or something like that, so it's the largest 401k of them all, has roughly about 60% of its assets in its F&G funds, which are essentially fixed income investments, which are similar to life products invested in. But it's so big that it's actually almost the Treasury duplicates an instrument which we manufacture by a life insurer. So this is all true, and this is all documented, okay, but... Lord help you try to get it on any popular press.
Well, and so for those of you who may not quite understand what some of the terminology Barry's using, ladies and gentlemen, what we're basically saying is a thrift plan is a retirement plan for government employees.
The government 401k.
Yeah, for that. Yeah, government 401k. And when they've got 70% or so of their money in fixed instrument, it makes you wonder how confident they are.
Yeah, and these guys are no. Well, the thing about it, look at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, I think, has more economists under one roof than anywhere in the world, okay?
Very bright people, there's no question.
So very, very bright. So you get 22,000 people. 22,000 people decide to put 70% of the money into fixed instruments.
Well, I don't know. What's the message we should take from that, Barry?
Well, the preservation of capital should be the first and fundamental tenet of investment advice. And even Benjamin Graham, who is the gods for guys like Warren Buffett and all of Wall Street, says, if an investment does not, provide protection of capital, then it's speculation.
Well, you know, what's interesting about Benjamin Graham, a lot of people don't know this, Barry, was Benjamin, obviously, and another fellow wrote, I forget the name of the book, I think it was Stock Picking and Analysis. It became the Bible back in the 30s. Did you know that he recanted stock picking on his deathbed in the 70s?
No kidding.
He actually said that after all these years, I realized stock picking really doesn't work. It was part of his information that started that whole concept of sell high, buy low, et cetera, so it's kind of interesting. It just goes to show how difficult it is to pick stocks versus just owning the market as a whole.
Yeah, it really is, and I was reading this interesting book for your listeners out there, Black Swan, but I've noticed that it was in, like 70% of the stocks which are on the S&P 500 index, I guess in the 50s, like 70% of them aren't even the S&P anymore. So,
right.
We don't even know what's going to happen. I mean, a lot of these companies just come and go.
Well, there's three times as many mutual funds open right now as there are individual stocks. There's 27,000 open mutual funds. There was 40,000 born since 1923. Almost 14,000 have been killed off. You never hear about any of those.
No, there was like 1,400 or something like that went down last year alone, but they bury the dead. They throw dirt over them, so you really don't hear about
them. Or roll them into another mutual fund.
Yeah, they roll them up, and so they just disappear. So they throw dirt on them, and no one sees them. But that's the mutual fund industry, but it really has a headlock on the debate in this country.
Well, you know what we're going to do, Barry? We're going to take a break here. We're listening. You're listening to It's Your Money. My name's Paul Nichols, your host. I'm joined by Barry Dyke, the best-selling author of Pirates of Manhattan. And when we come back, we're going to get into a little bit about banks, insurance companies, the safety thereof. There are a lot of people out there that are wondering about that type of thing. You're listening to It's Your Money. We'll take a brief break, and we'll be back on the other side. welcome back. This is Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. I hope this finds you well. If you're listening attentively, you probably noticed we're having a couple little glitches with our computer system over here. And that's why we just cut off that last deal. But I am back. This is It's Your Money. We're live and in color. It's a beautiful Saturday morning. We're full of liquid sunshine here in the Northeast. We're talking to the best-selling author friend, Barry Dyke, the author of Pirates Manhattan. Barry's from the New Hampshire up in New England area. He's been around a long time, very knowledgeable in the industry. Not only is he an author, but he also is a registered investment advisor, which even brings more weight to his opinion. Barry, we want to thank you again for coming on. Are you still with us?
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, I'm still here. Yes.
Wonderful. You know, Barry, I wanted to focus on really an area that you absolutely excel in as it relates to research, information, and acumen, and that would be in the area of safety of banks and life insurance companies. And I have never met anyone that has had the ammunition to really lay out to people what the deal is. I was wondering if you could speak to that, and I guess specifically I want to, in this segment, my main goal would be to get out to a lot of people out there in central Pennsylvania and a part of Maryland that really don't understand how safe insurance companies are, because they've got that old-time thinking from back in the Depression type of stuff. And so I want to try to educate people, because some people are worried about their annuity payouts, their pensions, their insurance stuff because of all the stuff that's been spoken about in the last year. So,
rightfully so. Essentially, the reason why it's really I'm a kind of a mathematical guy, you know. I'm a doubting Thomas numbers guy, Paul, like yourself. And simply put, the thing with the banks is they're always incredibly inherently leveraged risk-based models to begin with. Okay, so they're very, very leveraged. So what do I mean by that? For every dollar that a bank has on hand, as you know, Paul, they have their fractional reserve, where they have for every dollar they lend. Have on deposit of their money or their consumers' money, they lend out at a minimum of 1 to 10. So if they have $10,000 in customers' money in deposit, they're lending out a minimum of $100,000 on fractional reserves. But the problem is that Citigroup was lending out under this period was essentially lending out 17 to 1 or $170,000 to every $10,000 in deposit. And the Bear Stearns, the Lehman Brothers, the Merrill Lynch's, the Goldman Sachs were lending out. Are leveraging their balance sheets 30 to 1. So banks, by their very nature, are very, very leveraged. And then when you throw in their, you know, there was based upon overnight trading or overnight accounts, it's essentially a system based upon shifting sands. Whereas with a life company, it's a structural point of view, whereas with a life company, for every dollar that a life company has on reserve, they lend out money just like a bank does, but they only lend out essentially 90 cents on the dollar. So a life company, if you will, or insurance company, if you will, is essentially 100% reserve-based lending. They're not levering up their balance sheets. And which gives the consumer more protection is that, going back to the Armstrong Commission in 1905, is that life companies, by very nature, are regulated by states, i.e. like the state of Pennsylvania, and so life companies cannot speculate with their balance sheets. So a life company, if they're doing business in Pennsylvania, like a Penn Mutual who's based in Pennsylvania, they by law by the state regulators, they have to be 70% of the money is in bonds and so forth. So they'll always be safer just from a mechanical point of view.
So let me just put that, and that was very well articulated, but let me just dumb it down even more for some folks. What you're basically saying is that banks can loan 10 plus times their reserves on the books. So they're really leveraging themselves, which is really what happened to Citibank, right? I mean, it got itself way in over its head.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's why it happened. In fact, that was part of this whole credit default situation. Fannie Mae took a dump. As a result, the balance sheets took a dump. As a result, they're even leveraged heavily more. I mean, the balance sheet even looked
70
worse.
70 to 1, Paul.
Unbelievable.
70 to 1 on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Unbelievable. So what we end up having is banks have the ability to just leverage more. Whoa. Leverage more in the insurance than the insurance companies. But why did this perception then, if insurance companies can only loan out what their reserves all bury, and banks can loan out 10 plus times their reserves, where did this perception come from that banks are safer than insurance companies?
marketing, advertising,
really?
Control of Congress.
I'll tell you, you take anybody 50 or older, and you ask 100 of them what's safe for bank or insurance companies, I guarantee a 90-plus will say bank.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is the most unstable. And this is not just in America. This is worldwide, Paul. Because the life companies and banks are somewhat similar throughout the world, and actually the irony of the whole thing, which I found out, is you have your foreign banks are even more leveraged than that, like Deutsche Bank or something like that, is a German bank, and their leverage is they're actually leveraged out even more, 60-1. So the thing is that it's pretty much true throughout the world, but this is it, again, it's got to do with marketing. Who controls who and who's lobbying who, and so the truth. But the truth is that the Federal Reserve has most of their money in fixed instruments backed by life insurance companies. And the truth is that the Federal Thrift Plan has a majority of its assets in fixed instruments.
Yeah, and ladies and gentlemen, by the way, we don't want you to feel like we're bashing the banks, and that's not the intent here. The intent here is to pull back the curtain and expose the truth about the way this industry, financial industry as a whole, works. And a lot of people have a misconception about banks. I mean, how many banks default a year? How many banks default a year, you think, Barry?
Well, there's over 103 this year, Paul, and the year ain't over yet.
And that, and now this is a little bit unusual because of 08, but that normally you see close to 100 banks a year, don't you? I mean, it's not just an 08.
Well, you know, it kind of petered off in the 90s, after the S&L crisis. But now it's at... major clip. We've had IndyMac Bank go down. We've got Bank United. I mean, these are huge.
And they're not really publicized. I mean, it's not something here on the news.
No, that's why I've been tracking that. But over 103 banks as of today have gone under. And but the fact is that banks are very, very powerful. And the reason gets back to because the Federal Reserve is really looking out for the interest of the banks.
Well, and the banks are an important wheel in the cog of our overall machinery. I mean, obviously, it's a necessary component, and banks are, very useful. A lot of us, we need them, obviously.
We all need them.
Yeah,
we're not
bashing them. But how many insurance companies have defaulted this year?
I don't know of any.
Last year, the year before that? See, here's the thing. This is the thing that's interesting, and I don't know whether it's a component of the nature of the community and the climate that we live in. In central Pennsylvania, it's a lot of farms. It's very good stewards of the money. You got that Pennsylvania German influence, and a lot of people in this part of the country, I've noticed, are adverse to insurance because they just don't understand it. But they'll keep millions in banks and CDs and believe it really is the safest thing they could possibly do. So, how do you get people to understand that, in fact, it's just the opposite of what their perception is?
Well, that's kind of my goal in the rest of my career, Paul, is really to educate people about the truth. Well, the fact of the matter is that Mellon Bank, which is the old Mellon Banking Dynasty, which is merged with Bank of New York Mellon, has, 20% they have more money invested in life insurance than they do in all the real estate and the hard assets combined. And it's all true, and it's documented, and actually, I wrote one article, I don't know if you saw it, in Medical Economics, which had about 70,000 reprints and went out to about 170,000 doctors throughout the country. But this is all true. So I my feeling is just tell people the truth. I mean, and some people will get it and some people won't, but there's nothing I can do about it. Just tell them the truth.
Right, and that's one of the challenges that I have. And most people that if they're coachable and open-minded, which I've been so blessed with a lot of people that I work with, although they may not understand or disagree, they're open-minded to coaching and learning, and they will take the information and process that. Now, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink, right?
Exactly.
You can salt the oats a little bit, though.
Yeah, and Paul, even being a best-selling author, and I don't do a lot of plans now, but I still get referred to some people, and I do it to keep myself sharp. Some people they just don't get it, and but it is what it is, and but the more momentum is picking up, and the thing is if people build a house in sand, they know it's going to collapse eventually. If they build it on a castle rock, which you and I advocate, it has more chances of surviving. We don't know if a tornado could rip it off the castle rock, but this is But pretty much the fund industry and Wall Street saying put all your money on black and roll the roulette wheel. But the fact of the matter is, and this is the amazing thing, Paul, which I've learned, and this gets into my new book research, is that I found even these geniuses, the private equity firms, the hedge funds, and so forth, supposedly the geniuses, you know where they make their money?
No.
On fees.
Fees. Yeah.
They don't make it on the investment performance.
No, it's $100 billion a year, according to Professor French out of Dartmouth. Have you ever read his article on that?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So a lot of these institutions, it's like the banks don't make their money on investment. They're lousy at it. people think banks are smart. Look at what's going on right now. They're not. The fact of the matter is banks, the hedge funds, the private equity firms, the mutual fund companies, okay, these actively traded monsters, okay, make their money on fees.
A lot of turnover, and you know, the sad thing about that, look, most people have no problem paying their fair share of taxes or paying their fair share of fees. The challenge I have with the industry is most people are clueless about what they're paying.
Yeah, and I can't, some of the stuff, Paul, between the difference between the bid and the spread and the ask and all that stuff, I can't figure it out, and I mean, other experts had enlightened me about it, so there's so many factors there which, again, are behind the curtain, and they don't want us to figure out.
So now, we've talked a little bit of doom and gloom. What can a person do to get educated? Obviously, your book is a good place to start, Pirates of Manhattan. If you go to our website, Financial Abundance Inc., we have a whole reading list, recommended reading list of books. Obviously, your book is on there. What other information might people go to that are the type that like to think this stuff out, figure it out for themselves, so that, you know, we don't want to be all doom and gloom, because you and I are both positive guys.
Yeah, because America is a wonderful country, you know, and it's just, I think if you're born here, we live here, we've kind of won the lottery in the grand scheme of things. But read about banking. You know, of course, there's a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, which people should read about.
Absolutely,
which is by G. Edward Griffin, which is the book about how the Federal Reserve got created and the banking system. Because when you understand the banking system, you really understand what's going on. So it may all the pieces fit together when you understand the banking system. And then you'll understand what's really going on now. And then there's they can go to www.mises.org, which is the website for Ludwig von Mises Institute, which is about, it's the Austrian School of Economics. So it's a whole school of economics, which it really gets into fractional reserve banking and inherent problems in that. Really to educate themselves first and, really kind of stay away from Wall Street and just read. But there's a lot of good new material coming out as well.
Well, there's a lot of information. Now you've been, you're really high on this book. You were promoting to me the Black Swan, is it?
The Black Swan, yeah. Well, that's a book, yeah, which is, it's kind of funny, The Black Swan by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and he's kind of, he has his PhD in economics, and he was a trader for Wall Street Credit Suisse or something like that. And what he really kind of, which I love, is that he kind of just kind of says that, you know, life is random. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know about this, you know, credit default swaps or subprime mortgages. So we're going to have these random events happening, and a black swan is kind of like a random event. And they happen throughout history, and they happen again and again and again. And his attitude, and I believe in it now more than ever, is that we need to have a huge chunk of our money really safe, not at risk. And he's just kind of but the things we contend with, Paul, is the things like, i.e., modern portfolio theory, which is the kind of Gaussian mathematical model, which Markowitz and who the other guy, I forget,
William Sharpe and Merton Miller.
They got the Nobel Prize for. Which is really kind of, it was kind of now it's kind of like the bedrock of Wall Street and mutual fund business.
Well, you know what it is, but people don't practice it, Barry.
Yeah, and the whole thing is diversification. I mean, it works. I think really when you're having assets is retaining, and when you're making money, you really want to concentrate your efforts. So, but the whole idea of diversification, Paul, as we saw in the summer of 2007, when the markets collapsed, the only thing, this whole diversification, diversification model falls apart.
Right, and I think what we're basically saying is, and at least from my perspective, I believe in the academic approach to investing, but I don't believe in putting all your money in the market. That's really where you and I are standing. What we're saying is, hey, let's get the bulk of your money in a very secure place for your income, for your retirement. And then the other monies that you might need for inflation and buying power down the road, you want to have some money in the market. It's just...
I agree. And I agree with that wholeheartedly, and it's wonderful. And
it's just not one-size-fits-all type of thing.
Yeah. So I agree with that. The more I believe it... The fact of the matter is that if you want to look at it, demonstrate it, look at where the Federal Reserve employees put their money. And what has also enlightened me, too, is this: in the research in the private equity and the state pension funds, they're a mess. They're a mess. And the thing is that here are the supposed geniuses, and they're getting hammered. I mean, CalPERS, which is the largest pool of capital in the world, lost $58 billion.
Unbelievable.
You know, and so the thing is that, you know, I'm not saying, you know, but I'm saying, so doesn't this make sense putting some of this stuff in? But if we followed the advice that what the Federal Reserve was doing with their own money, they essentially sidestepped the whole mess.
Isn't it interesting? You know, we got to go to a break. We're listening, you're listening to, ladies and gentlemen, to It's Your Money, the show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry. And we're joined by best-selling author Barry Dyke. We're talking about banking. Life insurance and just finance in general, credit, the government. And when we come back in our last segment, we want to talk about the perception versus reality as it relates to the uses of life insurance. We want to specifically talk about BOLI, COLI, and retirement. We're joined by Barry Dyke. You're listening to It's Your Money, and we'll be back right after the break. Welcome back. This is Paul Nichols, your host. You're listening to It's Your Money. It is Saturday morning, and we're live and in color. And, man, this rain is not letting up. I don't know how it is up in New Hampshire right now, Barry, but we're getting flooded down here. I mean, I'm serious. It's like a river going down the gutters here. And, you know, did you guys get any snow last weekend?
Well, I said, yeah, it was snowing a bit.
Oh, that's right. I saw the game. It was snowing during the game last weekend, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was just, seriously, but... not ready for it, but nothing I can do about it.
Well, I'll tell you, around here we have a lot of trees, obviously, with the leaves still on them, and it looked like a war zone Saturday morning. Just anywhere you drove, there were just trees down, and the crews around here have been working overtime, landscapers and what have you. Really kind of freaky. It must be global warming, huh, Barry?
Yeah, I guess so.
Into January, right, in New England.
Yeah.
Well, for those of you just joining us, we're talking to, my name is Paul Nichols, we're talking to the best-selling author, Barry Dyke. He's also a registered investment advisor and very knowledgeable in the area of credit, finance, debt, government policy, this type of stuff. And we've just been talking about his book, The Pirates of Manhattan, and we are waiting with bated breath for his next book, which we're not sure what that's going to be name-wise. I know you're beating some ideas around the Pirates of Debt or the Pirates of whatever, but we're looking forward to that.
Greed, whatever, who did something like that, I don't know.
Yeah, and are you going to be kind of breaking down this what happened last year? Was that the intent, or did you just want to talk about the nature of credit?
Yeah, and the thing is, I'm just trying to, what is... And Frontline just did a really good piece. I don't know if you saw that the other week, this week, Paul. It was called The Warning. It was about how derivatives are not regulated. But I'm getting to that, and it's essentially just get how massive it really is. It's embedded into our society, how the whole culture of debt. And actually, that's a good name, The Culture of Debt.
There you go. There you go. That is a good name. I like that name.
But the thing is the how embedded it is. From everything, and from student loans to credit cards to the exploitation of credit by the banks and hedge funds and private equity, it's massive, and it's not just in this country, but it's actually kind of global in scope, and it is kind of a culture of debt, and unfortunately, it's predatory in nature in that it really hurts the consumers and regular people, but it really benefits Wall Street and the banks and financiers. And the thing is that what I've found is that when you're too big, you get bailed up. But if you're a regular person, someone who produces something, you're in a working hard person, like in Pennsylvania, you're the ones who get penalized. And so it's really kind of a culture of debt.
And you know, it's something that's I hate to make it sound this way, but it's almost like the Jekyll Island thing. Some good old boys in the back room kind of figuring out the way things are going to play out. Big money people I'm talking about. And
it is. Yeah, and it really involves them. And I didn't realize how much even private equity is. And that's really kind of the total exploitation of the tax code. And again, I'm not against that, but totally. But when I saw how abusive it was, it's incredible. But again, these folks are being paraded about as if the gods. And I don't know if you saw this, it came to light this week, is that CalPERS, the largest pension fund in the world, actually owns 9% of Apollo Group, which is the private equity firm in New York, which is involved in a number of things, amongst them the collapse of Linens and things like that, of that nature. And the facts are just fascinating. You couldn't make this stuff up, Paul.
It's almost like a house of cards, isn't it? Or not, a house of cards isn't the right word. It's like one's connected to the next, to the next.
Oh, it's a revolving door between Wall Street and government, and a lot of academic too, so...
And just to segue away from a little bit of it, it sounds like you and I kind of going on rants here. I wanted to kind of focus back in with about 10 minutes we have left here to talk about Bolli and Coli, because until we're familiar with these things, but until I read Pirates of Manhattan and have had a few conversations with you, I had no idea how much life insurance is really used in the corporate and banking environments. And I wanted to have you explain, like you did last time, about Tier 1 cash and banks and life insurance. Can you kind of share that story with the listeners?
Sure. Well, Tier 1 capital, for the folks out there listening, that's the most important asset of any bank. That's the heart of a bank. That's the lifeblood. Because the amount of Tier 1 capital a bank has determines how much money they can lend out to the public, which is really their whole reason to be. So every bank wants a good, large chunk of Tier 1 capital, because the more Tier 1 capital they have, the more they can lend out to the public and the more money they can make, which, if I was running a bank, makes sense. Now, also, the Tier 1 capital has to be something very, very safe because of for various reasons, and liquid and safe and so forth. But the major discovery I made in my professional life, and it's in the book, and again, the popular press will not acknowledge it, is that all your major banks, virtually all of them, in the United States, put a large portion of their own money, of their Tier 1 capital, their most important investment, into life insurance, and they do it for economic reasons, namely for because life companies can invest money better than life banks do. That's been pretty easy, if you just read the paper the past 2 years. They like the tax benefits. Unfortunately, they also, it's kind of ghoulish, but they understand that the rate of return at death when someone dies, the money coming to the bank is a great rate of return. And actually, this was actually touched on in Michael Moore's movie, Capitalism, a Love Story. He didn't get the whole story right.
No, he never does. That guy skews.
No,
things.
He didn't get some of the stuff was really good, but Michael Moore didn't get it right, because he was talking about Walmart, and Walmart closed that whole thing down 10 years ago.
Right.
But in any event, they buy for very selfish reasons, and rightfully so. And so when I started realizing how much the banks bought, I said, boy, doesn't this make even more sense for the individuals? Actually, it makes sense for the banks, but it actually makes more sense for the individuals.
Right, that is to own life insurance as your first Tier 1 cash reserve, so to
speak. As your Tier 1 capital, because it's a guaranteed line of credit. It provides a very large benefit for beneficiaries. After all, why do we do all this work? It's because of families and people we love and care about, you know, and the thing is, there's so much we can do on it, and I get into how, you know, Walt Disney started using life insurance to start his Disneyland, which is all true, and then JCPenney used it, and
Ford.
Yeah, and so it does work, and the best investment is obviously yourself, but the fact of the matter is that life insurance and annuity products our core investments of the nation's bank and the Federal Reserve System 401k in particular.
And, you know, just on a personal note, two-thirds of my money goes into cash value life insurance, and the rest of my money goes aggressively in the market. Now, what's interesting about that is it's just the opposite of what you think it is. The reason that the banks are safe is because of insurance companies, whether it be FDIC or whether it be the first tier, their cash reserves being in life. And by the way, Barry, a lot of people don't understand this because they may not deal with guys like me that deal with a little bit more sophisticated life strategies. I have not dealt with very many affluent clients that don't have quite a bit of money put away in cash value life insurance. What's your experience been? Because you deal with a lot of affluent people up in your part of the country.
It's funny, people. I'm in New England, and it's probably even tougher. I mean, I'm in New Hampshire, and you have some pretty crusty old Yankees here.
Yeah.
And some people get it, and some people it's a battle. I mean, I think the more sophisticated areas, I think it's an easier sell. Or an easier acceptance. If I'm talking New York. I mean, I'm in New Hampshire. I've sold more books in Montana, Paul, than I have in New England.
Isn't that interesting?
I've sold more books. It does very well in Colorado, in the South, in Ohio, in the Heartland, and those areas. And Pennsylvania's actually sold a lot. I've sold a lot in Pennsylvania, but where you're dealing with really wealthy areas. People are more acceptance of it. As a matter of fact, I know as a result of my book is one of the key top bond traders in Wall Street own a lot of life insurance because of my book. It's a true story. Because even some guys they work for like J.P. Morgan didn't realize how much J.P. Morgan actually owned in life insurance.
It's amazing, and I appreciate the way you listed it out in your book. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you that are local, just give our office a call, and we can get you a copy of Barry's book. I think we have a few copies left. We probably got to order another case, Barry, but you can go on Amazon, I believe, and get this book.
Yeah, Amazon, where it's marked up on Amazon, but they're better off to go to directly to the website, www.thepiratesofmanhattan.com, www.thepiratesofmanhattan.com. It's available directly for me. It's a little discount, but you can also get it on Amazon. And but it's about 10% to 20% cheaper for me direct.
And let me just share this with the lady, the listeners out there, Barry. This is self-published, so you might pay a couple bucks more for Barry's book than you would another book, but that's because he self-published it. And I'll tell you, not that it's extraordinarily expensive. I just want to make the point that when people get on, what is it, $25 or something, Barry?
No, it's $38.
$38.
Every penny of it, because yeah.
But it's $40 that'll be well spent, ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you. I mean, like I say, I buy them by the case, and we give them out. I mean, I give them to friends and relatives. Most of my aunts and uncles have all gotten a copy of the book. And you know, it's one of those things, it's an investment in your future. This is the type of stuff that you're just not going to find. And as a result of Barry self-publishing the book, there's more expenses involved with him doing that. So I just want to share that with people, because some people say, what, $40 for a book? Well,
good. These college textbooks would just tell you nothing. I mean, I see my kids. I've got my youngest. I got three kids in college now, and the textbooks, which I hate to say, a lot of them have nothing in them. They have to pay $120 in them, and I have a lot of research. I spent 10 years of my life just researching this first book, and so the rate of return for people is phenomenal. And the thing is that there's not a really, the great thing about the book is it's great for the ego, but there's not really that much money in books.
No, it's not a money maker. I know we got one as well.
No.
People think you're going to get rich because you wrote a book, man, but that's not the case.
No, you don't make.
And by the way, hey, Barry, I'm a mile from campus, Penn State, so we do, and the bookstore, in fact, and we're probably about a mile from the bookstore, and we do understand you're going to pay $120 for a used book. I mean, let's get real. You know what I mean?
My kids? I must have spent $1,500 for my kids' books this year. And they don't have any content.
Yeah, and just watch them eat the covers off the books, right? The kids don't even use them. I'm just joking.
Yeah. So I put some great research in it, and then just distribute it in, the county. So there's not a lot of money in it, but yeah. I'm grateful that I'm able to do it.
Well, take advantage of it, ladies and gentlemen. Amazon.com or piratesofmanhattan.com. Or, of course, you can give us a call or go to our website. And if you want to, ladies and gentlemen, you can always check out iTunes, type in Financial Abundance in the store, and this this will be on as a podcast beginning of the week, and we have Barry's show from about a year ago. Barry, you came on October 4th of last year, by the way.
Wow, was that a year ago? Wow,
yeah.
By, huh?
Yeah, so it's been a little over a year. Both the original Pirates interview and of course, this one will be on there. Let's segue with the 3 or 4 minutes that we had left. We talked about bank-owned life insurance and the fact that banks keep a lot of life insurance on the books because it's first-tier cash. But what about COLI, corporate-owned
life insurance? Well, that's huge, too. And banks, you know, that's a very big piece. Is that I think roughly 1,600 public companies use life insurance as a way to set up private pension plans. And I've gone through every single one of them. Give an example like GE, which is kind of more of a bank than an industrial
company. Yeah, finance, yeah.
GE actually has over 4,400, I repeat, 4,400 of its top executives covered in an executive life insurance plan. So it's a fundamental part of their overall compensation.
Now, they must have millions in that. Hundreds
of
millions.
We really don't know. Because you only have to list the top five for publicly traded companies. So we know five people make life insurance, but we don't know what the other 4,300 of them, 50 have. So all these major, very major, and it makes all the sense in the world. It's an ideal method to compensate people. It's an ideal method to fund private selective pension plans. It makes all the sense in the world.
And it's great for taxes for the actual executive when they retire, because then they get
that
tax-free income stream.
Yeah, tax-free income stream, or conversely, you know, but it's a good way, you know. And the whole thing is all the listeners out there got to understand every single pension plan, every single annuity in the country is based upon life insurance principles.
Mm-hmm.
Every state employee or your state college right there, TIA, CREF.
Yeah, university, that's what they use.
It's an annuity and insurance company.
It's all insurance. All those state pension plans, the university pension plans, many private pension plans. It's just that people aren't educated about this, which is why we're doing the show here. With about the minute we have left, Barry, I want to thank you for your time. We know that one point I wanted to make with corporate-owned life insurance, by the way, is when you hear about these golden parachutes, a substantial part of the golden parachute comes in the form of life insurance proceeds to the executive when they leave. A lot of people weren't familiar with that. But anyway, you know, Barry, it's been a pleasure having you on, as it always is. In fact, it's always a pleasure just to chat with you. You're very intelligent, insightful individual, and it's an honor to be able to hang with you here on the radio and personally. Any final thoughts you want to lay out there?
Yeah, just caveat emptor, really. People educate yourself, because it behooves you really to understand this stuff. So you can have a much better and happier life for you and your family.
And I'll tell you, for those of you who obviously don't know Barry, you got to know where Barry's heart's at, and he's the real deal. Barry, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless.
We'll talk to you. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, It's Your Money, Paul Nichols. Coming right up behind me here is Professor Pash, the Ken Pash, and Unlocking Your Full Potential. And then right after that, Brian Allen. I hope that the show has found you well. Hope you picked up a little nugget here or there. Stay out of the rain. Stay dry, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week. Have a great day.